They were the heroes from the future. Teenagers protecting the universe from those that would sow the seeds of chaos. Each had unique powers and abilities. And though they often had their differences, they came together to save the day as the Legion of Superheroes. Now, you can be a part of their adventures and learn the history of the future in the Legion Clubhouse.
We are in an era of the Legion where we are doing 8-page stories. But even though there are 8-page stories, these two issues that we're going to be talking about this week have a lot of implications of things that are currently going on and maybe a weird dystopian look of the future. Ooh, I'm kind of scared about that.
Action Comics number 381, The Hapless Hero, published October 1969, written by Jim Shooter, with art by Wynn Mortimer and Jack Abel. Synopsis: Matter Eater Lad and Shrinking Violet go on a date, but her boyfriend isn't happy about it.
Matthew, there's nothing worse than two guys fighting over a girl, especially when the girl is into both guys.
Well, actually, there is one thing worse, and that's if one of the guys literally has the power to do whatever he can imagine.
I'm going to have to make a confession here, because I know we've read these issues, the two other issues or three other issues that Duplicate Boy has been in. I can't remember him at all.
Because he didn't look like this. Duplicate Boy was one of the heroes of Lalor. You remember when?
Yes, I remember they went to her planet.
The radiation, and they came to Earth. And then they came back when Beast Boy went insane, captured all the Legionnaires and made them fight each other. And then Beast Boy, not Gar Logan from the Teen Titans, but Beast Boy, I think his name is Ishu Noor, from Lalor, died. And during that second story, he struck up a romance with Shrinking Violet that was never followed up on.
Well, and I think that there's a reason. I think there's a reason why that they've never followed up on, because in one panel, she's talking about how she went out to meet him or something. And she's like, yeah, we were supposed to go hook up. But then we decided that we met really briefly on the moon. And she's like, oh, kid, I missed you so. And he's like, and I missed you. Shrinking Violet. I don't have any time now, but I promise I'll call you soon. This guy's just stringing her along. And then they were supposed to have a big date on the night of this issue takes place. And he doesn't show up. I think he's stringing her along, man.
You know what I think?
What?
And this actually becomes his long-term characterization. Ord Qualu, also known as Quaid Orlu.
Yes.
Quaid Orlu is actually a mistake because the heroes of Lalor, their names get confusing. Because Duplicate Boy pops up once every 7 to 8 years, they've called him both Quaid Orlu and Ord Qualu and Qualu Ord. And years later in Who's Who, they finally said, well, on Lalor, they don't differentiate between the first and last name. So Ord Qualu and Qualu Ord are both right. And at which point everybody went, what about Quaid Orlu? And they're like, that never happened. But nonetheless, Ord Qualu, Duplicate Boy.
Yes, he has to get to Mars.
He is a big, dumb, idiot jock.
This yes, I agree with you on that, too. But he's also just very manipulative, where he's probably got like 15 girls on the hook for when he's actually lonely and she's must be down on the lower on the list because he doesn't want to hook up with her. No, I know guys like this.
Qualu would put poor Vi on his hook.
If he's got someone else that is just as hot and more willing to put out, yeah, I think so. I know guys that act just like this. And
something
it's horrible.
Else about this issue that puzzles me.
What?
Ord Qualu generally wears a green leotard with black pants and diamonds on them. In this issue, and this issue only, he wears a costume that looks like Stone Boy, and his hair, instead of being the normal black, is kind of a brown color. And I'm like, did they mistake Duplicate Boy for Stone Boy?
Well, and I guess my question is, because, again, I have no recollection of Duplicate Boy. Isn't he just like Ultra Boy?
Duplicate Boy can duplicate
any power.
Any power, but he can duplicate sets. So Duplicate
so he could have flying and invulnerability.
I'm going to have the powers of Superboy.
And
later on, we find that, you know, they put a limit on him by indicating that not only is he a big dumb jock, he's not very imaginative. He can have any power that he imagines. He's just a dullard. So he's like, I'm going to have the powers of Superboy, or I'm going to have the power to grow real big and fight Colossal Boy. By the way, he comes back in a few years and fights someone else for Shrinking Violet's honor. We'll get there in a few episodes, or about 100 episodes, but that's not the point.
I guess, but I mean, this guy. He's such a horrible, horrible person. Also, I want to comment, and again, we're talking about an 8-page story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Ultra Boy and Phantom Girl are supposed to be dating, right? They're supposed to be totally in love with one another. And so they're getting a ride home from, who is it, the Chemical King?
Chemical King has a brand new car because he's a rich kid.
Yes. He's showing off his big roadster and everything. And so he's going to take the Legionnaires home at the end of the night as they sign off duty. And they drop off a Phantom Girl, and Ultra Boy's like, good night, love. And she's like, oh, good night to you, too. I can't wait to get home because my parents are visiting, and they're going to make a delicious dinner for me. Bye. And it's like, Ultra Boy, you might want to use this as a clue that maybe she's not as into you as you are into her, because why is she not inviting him to dinner with the parents?
That is not how that goes. Now, why?
That's exactly how it goes.
Here's the thing. And this is the thing we forget. The Legionnaires are at this point 15 years old.
Oh, I got to comment about that in a minute, but go ahead and finish.
They're 15 years old. And so they are not at a point where they're like, oh, we're going to bring you home to meet mom and dad. They're at a point where they're like, hey, let's go to tennis practice and hang out. And maybe you can teach me to drive. And also then we'll go fight the Fatal Five. Also, when Ultra Boy gets out of Chemical King's car, he does this beautiful swan dive right through the roof of his house. He's just like...
Yeah, it's really bad. So real quick about how old these kids are supposed to be. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's because we have Jack Abel or Abel doing the inking. Mm-hmm. But on that first page, Saturn Girl, Lightning Lad, even... Shrinking Violet and Duplicate Boy, they don't look 15. They look more like 19, 20 years old. And I don't ever remember seeing, and throughout this issue, these teenagers look a lot older than they're supposed to come off.
Yeah, well, and I think that's just Win Mortimer and Jack Abel working together. You know, we've seen this before with Mortimer, and I've commented on this in previous issues. Whoever... Wynn's inker has a lot of input.
We had that one issue
where it's like it was Win Mortimer and I can't remember who, maybe Murphy Anderson. And I'm like, this is really great art. I'm really happy with this. And then the next issue, we go back to Win Mortimer with somebody else, mm-hmm. and it's a completely different thing. And I'm wondering is if Win just pencils really lightly and the inker gets to put a lot of personality into it or what?
I think that's it. I think we see that a lot too because. Just recently, I've looked at some other artists, and their art style is completely different than what I remember even 10 years ago. And artist styles will change. But then I go back and look and say, oh, back then, this person was inking this artist. And now this person is inking the artist. And that inker is having a lot of say on what that final look looks like.
Yep. If you look at, say, Frank Miller inked by Klaus Janson.
Yes. That's what
Miller inked by somebody else. It's a completely different.
Yes,
ballpark.
John Romita. It is totally different, and it's totally going to blow your mind when you look at that. So
I just blow your mind.
Nah, because I kind of knew that it was coming. So anyway. Matthew, Chemical King is giving fellow Legion members a ride home. We've already mentioned Ultra Boy, and we've also mentioned Phantom Girl, but there's a fourth person in the car.
Yeah, and when Chemical King is like, hey, where should I drop you off? You don't live here. Why don't you just, I'll just take you to your house. He's like, nope, no, I'll just walk it from here. Bye.
Matter Eater Lad, a.k.a. Tinsel Kim.
Yeah. The Kim family
doesn't
lives on
want
the bad side of town.
Well, not just the bad side of town, but they live in the slums. I mean, he even says that we live in the slums.
Yeah. And this... To my knowledge, and I may be wrong, this is one of the first times I remember them addressing that poverty and economic inequality still exist
in
the year 2969. It's always been a shining city of Metropolis, and nobody has money and nobody needs money. And you go to the Nine Planets ice cream parlor and you get free ice cream.
I don't think it's free because otherwise the fact that the Kim family living in the slums wouldn't be a big deal. Now, I know that there are people right now who are looking at, and these are government officials, who are debating about a, what is it called, standard minimum income or something like that. I forget what the actual name of it is. Or a guaranteed universal income, where the idea is everybody gets a set salary, whatever that may be, $32,000 a year, $50,000 a year. They haven't really come up with the exact number yet. But if every person was guaranteed $50,000 a year, then they know that their bills would be basically paid. To right. where people wouldn't have to go work at a minimum wage job. People wouldn't have to go and work at a job that they don't like. And one of the benefits, and this has actually been tested in other countries and has actually proved to kind of work in the countries that they're testing. I think Norway is one. It's European countries. But they find out that these people who could just sit around all day and do nothing and have this money come in and pay for their stuff, these people are actually going out and getting jobs and doing things that they've always wanted to do, like be an artist or be a writer or go and take music classes or go and teach a class. And right. so there are these benefits to the universal minimum or the minimum universal income. However, as we see in the future, we don't have that. And there are people still in poverty in the United yeah. States. These are facts from the Monroe Group. Mm-hmm. 46 million people live in poverty in the United States. That's 38% increase over the last 13 years. And almost wow. the highest in almost 60 years. And more than 11 million Americans now pay more than half their salaries for monthly income or rent. So just think about that. These are, yeah, and this is just the Monroe Group talking about an affordable housing crisis. U.S. minimum wage $7.25 as of this recording, a renter would need to work 90 hours per week to afford a one-bedroom rental at the fair market rent and 112 hours per week to afford a two-bedroom apartment.
Yeah. That, yeah.
And this is where we find the Kim family.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because this is another reference I've seen. I want to say we've seen one before to the fact that Legionnaires get paid.
Yes. This is what happened when the when R.J. Brand basically took over the organization and decided to fully fund it. He made sure that all of the Legionnaires are getting a salary. And this is the part of the story that gets really, really creepy. Tinsel shows up at home. His mom's watching TV and she's like, oh, where have you been? Did you get it? And he's like, what? He's like, your check, your monthly check, your living allowance. You know, we need that to keep going. Your father's pension only goes so far. And we find out that his dad's, you know, gambling all the money away and he won't let his wife work. And the one thing that is the creepiest about this whole exchange, not only that the parents are depending on these 15-year-old, 17-year-old, 21-year-old kids
yep.
to bring support in the income, the family, to support basically. Them, which, you know, again, that's another thing that actually happens. You find kids that are, you know, 14 years old, once they hit the legal age, they are expected to go to work to help support the family.
Right.
The thing that is chilling when you read this exchange is this exchange is straight out of Jim Shooter's life. We've talked about this before where on previous episodes where he was so guilt, you know, so tied up in knots over Mortimer calling him up and yelling at him all the time.
Right.
That he was thinking of quitting, but his mom kept coming to him and saying, oh, you know, we need this money. This money is really helping us. And we know that his dad, the reason why he started working for DC was because his dad got fired and he needed the money. The family needed the money. And so this money that Jim Shooter was making was vital to keeping their family going and keeping a roof over their head and keeping them from becoming homeless. And when I read this, my jaw dropped. I mean, we've talked before about Jim Shooter inserting, you know, oh, here's what he's learning this week in school, The Odyssey. Right. So he's putting this in here. But here is him telling people, this is what it's like to be poor. This is what it's like to be yeah. have your family dependent upon you and the pressure that is put upon you as a kid to go out and earn for your family. And it is just shocking and sad. And it's frightening. I mean, it's really, really chilling and frightening.
It really is. And the thing, you know, after saying all that, I feel guilty about this because all I can think of now is The Breakfast Club. You know what I got for Clordney this year? It was a banner year at the Tenzel Chem house. I got a carton of cigarettes. The old man grabbed me and said, hey, eat up, Tenzel.
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of the way Dad is, right? I can really see how you're making that Breakfast Club comparison.
I didn't get smart with my old man. I had respect. And he's all unkempt and disheveled. And the implication is that maybe he's had a little too much joy juice. And Tenz is just like, maybe you had something to respect.
Yeah. Well, his dad, it's not really clear. I mean, he got a pension from working 20 years at the robot plant, but that closed down. And that also struck me as really, really weird because, again, I'm not trying to make this one side is good and one side is bad in our political debate.
Right.
But there is one side in our political institution that really, really pushes the fear of robots taking our jobs.
Mm-hmm. And the fear of automation is very, very real, especially in, you know, many jobs where it is more of a, you know, a physical or laborious process.
Yes. And so what has happened, instead of trying to advance technology and using monies to retrain people who might be displaced by robot output, they use this as a fear. But instead of a fear of pointing at robots, they're using this as a fear of the migrant worker is coming in to take your jobs.
Yeah. And it's interesting because he puts the words in the mouth of Shrinking Violet, but Shooter makes a good point about living in poverty. Mm-hmm. You know, Tenzel is just like, oh, well, whatever. And Shrinking Violet is like, you grew up poor. You had no way of, you know, knowing this. You had no way of interacting with that. You had no other frame of reference. And
right.
I really like what a deep statement that is in an 8-page backup strip in, you know, a future comic from 1969.
So how does Shrinking Violet find out that Tenzel's family is poor?
His dad
kicks him out of the house and says, get out, you worthless little SOB with your little superhero job. I work for a living. Look at my hands with all these calluses from making robot parts all day.
And rather, actually, he had to chew the robot parts out of steel.
Yeah, that's right. Wait a minute. If they're, I mean, again, I'm not trying to make fun of poor, but they can eat literally anything. So they're not going to starve. They're literally just needing a roof over their heads.
Essentially, yeah. But Tenzel decides that, well, Vi is upset and I kind of have a crush on her and she's, you know, having a breakdown because her boyfriend scammed out on her. So I'm going to take my whole check that could be used to support my family and I'm going to cash it all and take her to the best restaurant and dancing at the hottest club and rent a car with a robot chauffeur. And I'm going to show her a really good time until her crazy boyfriend shows up from Lalor.
No. There's a reason why he shows up from Lalor, right? It's such a fun evening. These two are having such a wonderful time that when they get back to the Legion headquarters, they start macking on one another. They are making out hot and heavy. And then biff, bang, boom, Duplicate Boy shows up and he's like, hey, you're muscling in on my woman. How dare you do this? Prepare to fight for the death, which is another thing that someone who's keeping a girl on the hook would do. The minute that the girl shows interest in anyone else, suddenly the boyfriend shows up and shows all of his muscles and is like, how dare you try to step in on my woman? She's the only one for me. And then wants to fight. So this is like classic casebook. I mean, again, I know guys who do this and who brag about it.
The best part, though, is that Duplicate Boy shows up and he rips down a pylon of the building and he crushes it in his bare hands. And he's like, "Arr!" And Tenzel's like, look, dude, I know you can kill me right now, but if you really love this girl, you kicking my butt won't fix anything and it'll make her hate you. And Duplicate Boy's like, oh no, the mighty Duplicate Boy defeated by words.
And then he's like, have I lost you? And she's like, oh silly, I was just kissing on him just because you weren't here and I was lonely. I still love you. Which is also really, really weird.
A really terrible thing to say right in front of Tenzel's face.
Well, it's weird on so many levels because, and I don't know at what point in 1969 these things are occurring, but Soldier would go off to war, mm-hmm. not around, leaves his bride behind. There is some guy who is not off at war, who suddenly steps into the picture, and the wife is stepping out, getting involved romantically with this other guy. And then when the husband shows back up from war, it's all back to, nope, this is my husband.
Right.
And I love him, and I'm not going to go with you, Johnny.
You're my dude on the side, Johnny. You're not my side dude.
Yeah. This kind of reminds me, not so much, but there's bits and pieces of this story that kind of remind me of Kenny Rogers' Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town. The bad thing about that story, though, is the guy comes back from war. He's in a wheelchair. Yep. His wife continues to step out on him to his face. But there's bits of this that, Ruby, don't take your love to town. Shrinking Violet, don't take your love to town.
That's how the song goes.
If but at the end of the story,
why I'm making these train noises, yes, that's literally in the song.
At the end of the story, though, at the end of the story, it kind of has a happy ending.
Does it, though?
I guess. I don't know.
The very next day at Legion headquarters, Brainiac 5's like, hey, you got a letter. And Tenzel's like, oh, my parents want me to come home. They're going to change. Dad's even given up gambling. The end.
Which, you know, he's excited about that. And I know we've only got 8 pages to wrap this up. But at no point does Shrinking Violet turn around to him and say, your dad has a gambling addiction. You can't cure a gambling addiction in a single day. You are going back to an abusive household. Stay here.
Do you want me to ruin it for you?
Sure.
Okay, look at that last panel. Look at the look on Tenzel's face.
Yeah, he's happy.
That is not a smile. That is not a smile. Here's the read on it that will ruin the Legion forever. Tenzel knows that it's hopeless.
Yeah,
he knows that his dad is an addict. He knows that everything's going to be the same in a week or two or a month. And he's like, you know what? I'm just going to live with the existential terror of my family coming apart at the seams because we don't have any money and my dad goes out and gambles it all. It's a terrible moment there because you're like so depressed at the end of, I'm sorry.
And again, I know exactly what you're talking about. And believe me, yeah. Yes, I agree with you. He knows he's going back.
Yeah.
And it is a weird, sad intro. But again, imagine 10-year-old kids who might be reading this, who might be coming from a home family situation that may be similar where the dad has a problem or the dad or the mother are abusive or whatever it may be. And here's this thing. It's like, oh, well, Matter Eater's lad's dad said he was going to change. Maybe my dad will change too. And so maybe this is supposed to give a little bit of hope to the younger readers who may not be fully aware of what's going on. But at the same time, I also want to say that readers who are in this situation also know that it isn't going to change.
God, that's depressing.
I know, right? I told people at the beginning of this episode, these are short stories, but holy cow, there is a lot to unpack in Action Comics 381. What is Shrinking Violet's take on people who are lower income? Because she just kind of plays it off as like, oh, well, this isn't your fault.
Right.
But there's no commentary on, look at how all the Richies live, where they can go to the top of the mile high gravity ball, anti-gravity ballroom and drink from the nectar of Venus and do all these things that, you know, she kind of expects.
Yeah. She's like, well, you have no material things and no way to comfort yourself with them. And you're isolated because you don't have any money. And he's like, well, what advice can you give me? She's like, oh, I can't give you any.
I know, right? And it's just like, oh my God.
This is really just a point where, you know, we're going to find out what you're made of. And if you fail, you fail. Oh, well, bye.
Yeah, which is also
my boyfriend now.
Which is also, it's like, it seems like she just brushes it off. It's like, oh, well, that's how you were born into this lower class. You can never get yourself out of that.
Or, you know, you pull yourself up by your bootstraps or you don't.
Which also doesn't work.
Well, yeah, but, you know, it's 1969.
I know. I don't even know when did that phrase come into
pull
being.
Up your bootstraps. Yeah. 1856.
Really?
Yeah. 1856. That's when it came around. I'm sure of it.
1922 is when James Joyce alluded to it in Ulysses.
Right.
And then it became a more explicit phrase in the Kunitz and Haycraft's British Authors of the 19th Century. And then it was really co-opted by a certain political party in the 1950s.
The Whigs.
Yes, that's what it was. It was the Whigs. Those darn Whigs and Tories always causing problems in our political system. But
Well, don't say Tories. There are still active Tory.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. So we're talking about the old Tories, not the new Tories. No, not them.
No, we're talking about Tory spelling.
Yes. Darn you, Tory spelling.
If you enjoy the show, we would appreciate your support. You can find out more and become a Legion Clubhouse member at patreon.com/majorspoilers.
I have skipped reading the intro story in these action comics. I mean, I know they're great classic stories featuring swan art and all these other things, Matthew. But one thing that I took away from Action Comics 381 is, once again, Superman is being a dick. Why is there this continued push to make Superman this horrible despot that wants to rule over the world?
Well, there are a couple of different reasons for it. I mean, Superman as a character is described as literally having all the powers.
Yes, he does.
You know, Superman can fly, he can breathe in an empty vacuum, he's invulnerable, he's got laser vision.
He's
got
to fly through a sun as clean as cape.
Right. With different, in different eras, we have different responses and different ways to put limitations on that. So in the 1950s, what we saw was a lot of Superman toying with his friends, playing with his friends, teasing and taunting in kind of a 50s, you know, punch you in the arm kind of way. And one of the central tenets of Superman lore is that Superman is Superman and disguises himself as Clark Kent and occasionally will turn and wink at the reader and be like, ha ha, if only Lois knew. And that kind of became a central part of the Silver Age, was Superman kind of winking and even tweaking the noses of Lois and Jimmy and Perry White and being kind of teasing about, oh, well, maybe I'm Superman. Ha ha. And they're like, oh, that's silly, Clark. And he's like, if only you knew. It's another kind.
Do you think this is like Superman's wish fulfulfulment? You think Superman is really sitting there going, oh man, I wish that I could just take over this planet and teach these point heads how the right way to live is?
Well, Superman knows something that you don't know. And while you as a reader, and I say you in the general you, but like a teenager or a kid in 1969, you don't know what it's like to lift a car, but you do understand what it's like to have a secret.
Oh.
You do understand what it's like to have the power of knowledge that no one else has. And I think that it appeals to writers and it appeals to readers for Superman to have these secrets that no one knows as another part of his I am the most powerful guy thing. I know something that no one else knows.
I also wonder if it is also an outshoot of, you know, here is Superman who's all powerful and he's a goody goody and he would never do anything. You know, this Superman is boring argument that people bring up every so often, or actually all the time with Superman.
Right.
If this is not a response to stuff that was happening in the 60s where people is like, eh, Superman's not that cool. He's just a goody goody and he's all powerful. He's not interesting. And so they're like, OK, let's make him interesting by doing horrible things and show you that in the end, as horrible as these things are, he's either being controlled by someone else or he's better than this or he's just pulling a Shrek on someone. And
or it's a dream.
Or it's a dream. Yeah.
Hoax.
And in the end, yes, yeah, Superman is still the good guy, but we've shown you why you don't want him to be the bad guy.
Right. And it's come to a point where in modern storytelling, Superman but evil has been done so many times in so many ways that as soon as you say, I know there's a big movie come out that's like Brightburn or.
Oh, yeah. I'm interested in seeing that. And again, depending on when you're listening to this, it's already in the theaters right now as you're listening to this, or it's been out on DVD for a while. Hello, future people. I'm kind of interested in seeing this only from the, oh, my God, what have you done to the Superman trope aspect of it?
Right. But Superman only evil. Or, you know, in modern parlance, Superman only fighting Batman. Whatever you get into, it's actually something that we've seen 1,000 times. And what it really shows, much like the quandary of Arm Fall Off Boy, is it shows which people have actually read the comics, which people are actually functionally familiar with the Superman lore. Because Superman is not evil. He's just a jerk. Superman wouldn't, you know, destroy the world and melt everything down with his eyes and take over the world and be the new Justice Lord. But he would sneak around and put poop in all of our shoes.
Oh, that's Superman.
And it's green poop, too. So it's
Krypton poop. That's what happens when you eat too many of the fruity pebbles from Krypton. Hey, so a couple of other things that are going in the letters column that I thought we should bring up right now. There's actually a question that appeared in this same issue of 381 about Duplicate Boy.
Yes, the letter column actually has a really great, kind of a classic Legion query. What would happen if Duplicate Boy, who can have any power of which he can conceive, fought Nemesis Kid, who can counter immediately any power with which he's attacked? What happens?
Protons and antiprotons colliding, the universe explodes.
Well, and you know, what I love is the fact that Weisinger, or more likely at this point, E. Nelson Bridwell, who is his assistant editor, gave a really solid, simple response. Remember how Nemesis Kid was beaten by Duplicate, or by Triplicate Girl? Because he can only fight one opponent, but he couldn't fight two duo damsels, so they punched him in the face. Duplicate Boy could just duplicate Duo Damsel's powers and be two Duplicate Boy.
Yeah, look at that. Way to go. Way to go,
that's
editors.
That's not a good answer. I believe that it would be a months-long crossover ending with somebody getting stabbed from behind with a trident because it's written by Geoff Johns.
12 issues long, spanning, I don't know, 3 years, even though they said it was going to come out monthly, and then it's three years later, and they're only at issue 9.
No, Duplicate's Day Clock is what it's going to be called.
The Duplicate's Day Clock.
Yeah.
There's another in issue 382. There's another interesting letter that is written in, a question that's written in. There's one from a soldier, which seems rather. I don't know if it's real. That's the only thing that I have a concern about on the one from the soldier from Vietnam. But another person writes in and says, hey, me and my friend are having this problem. You know how a lot of people pronounce Thanos as Thanos?
They didn't say that. This is 5 years before Thanos existed.
But that is something that literally happens right now, where people say Thanos instead of Thanos.
Right.
But he's like, how do you pronounce Mon-El? M-O-N-E-L. We've always had this problem, this question. My friend wants to pronounce it this way, and my other friend wants to pronounce it this way. I pronounce it this way. What? Please tell us, dear DC editor, what is the one true way to pronounce this? And the editor responds, we pronounce it Mon-El.
Which,
as in moan when our writers come to us asking for their checks or something along that lines.
What an editor does when he sees letters pointing out boo-boos. Moan,
yes, that's
L.
It. Yes, Mon-El.
Now, I can't tell if that's a joke or not, but it should be noted that within the DC offices until about 77, when the actual Superman movie came around, they pronounced the planet like the noble gas.
Krypton.
So it was not Krypton. It was Krypton.
Yeah.
Superman came from the planet Krypton. And Kryptonite is named for planet Krypton. Mm-hmm. This was apparently a thing at DC. You pronounced it Krypton, or you were pronouncing it wrong.
Right.
So if they pronounced it Mon-El, if they really did that, and I don't know that they did because of that moan joke, I think it's one of those things that changed. Because Mon actually made it to television in the year 2016 in an official DC project.
Well, but he's also been in animated series. He's been around for a long time in other forms where his actual name is pronounced. My issue with Mon-El is, do you call it Monday? Is that how you pronounce Monday?
Because Monday, born on a Monday.
You have to remember that Mon-El was found on a Monday.
Yeah.
And so,
well,
Mon,
then why is he not Mon-El?
Well, because he's Mon, Monday. And
Mon-El.
So, I mean, just from that point, I mean, that's how he got his name. Superboy sitting there going, oh, yeah, you're my cousin, so you have to be from the House of El. And I found you on a Monday, so we'll call you Mon-El.
Somewhere there's a universe where his name is actually Thurzel.
I was really glad that they didn't call him Mon-El. That would have been really bad.
Action Comics number 382, Kill a Friend to Save the World. Published November 1969. Written by Jim Shooter, with art by Wynn Mortimer and Jack Abel. Synopsis: Legionnaires are forced into mortal combat.
Okay, Action Comics, Tales of the Legion of Superheroes, Action Comics number 382, Kill a Friend to Save the World. What would you do, Steven, if you were forced to do mortal combat with
It is the age-old debate, right? The good of the one outweighs, or the good of the many outweighs the good of the one, or the needs of the one. I would totally kill a friend. I would, if it was like, Steven,
and this is why
in
no
order
one will
to
go play paintball with you anymore.
If it means that the world can be saved if you make one sacrifice, and all these millions and billions of people could live, I would go and make that one sacrifice, even if it might be, you know, literally mentally mind shattering, reducing me to babbling for the rest of my life. I would totally do that. I mean,
see.
And that's just me just saying, okay, the logical thing, like Spock would say, is
the needs one, of the many.
Yeah, the needs of the many are just too great for this one person. And I know we like to think a lot about ourselves individually. That's where your ego comes from. But right. When I think that if I could do one thing right now that could totally save the planet and all the people on it from suffering horrible fates in the next 30 years, I would totally do that.
Do you want to save the planet? See, and the thing that's most fascinating about the title of this issue story is the fact that it actually references something that takes place about halfway through the story for three panels and right. isn't really the central thrust of the issue.
But it's a good hook, right? I mean, that's what you need in the story, is a good hook.
It is a great splash page with Timberwolf fighting Karate Kid to the death, or you know, to the pain.
Mm-hmm.
But then the story really starts off in this weird, wacky place where Ultra Boy is just walking down the street.
No,
I'm Ultra Boy.
He's not in a weird, wacky place. Well, maybe it is in today's standards. He is in a mall, which, again, if we're talking about looking at this comic through the lens of today, malls are closing left and right. In the 60s, the strip malls opened, then the indoor malls opened as well. And the mall is where you went to interact. In the 80s, when Matthew and I were late 70s, early 80s, the mall was the place to go. The mall has it all. You go and look at Fast Times at Ridgemont High. That entire thing took place at a mall, basically. It was, what is this culture and how has mall culture evolved our lifestyle? And you can go back into many movies from the through the 60s through the mid 80s, and you will see there is even a movie from Kevin Smith called Mall Rats, where the mall plays a central part in the story.
Dawn of the Dead takes place in a mall. Chopping Mall takes place in a mall.
Yes, those are all allegories for
Mall and the Family.
The problem is, though,
there's Darth Mall.
Since Reagan's since the economic problems of the 80s, and with the rise of content coming into our homes, VCRs, DVDs, digital streaming, Amazon's rise. Big box stores like Walmart and Best Buy, there have been fewer. And the fact that also many movie theaters have extracted themselves from the mall to become multiplexes on their own. There have been fewer and fewer reasons to go to the mall, and malls are closing left and right across this nation. There's a great article in Time Magazine. This is from July of 2017. That is talking about the mall closures of America. In fact, there are many malls in America and around the world that are just empty spaces that people go into now and do the urban exploring. There's some great videos. I think Casey Nyquist took an abandoned mall and turned it into a Christmas paradise for a bunch of underprivileged kids, and had all sorts of activities that they could do in that mall throughout the day. And the people that were doing behind the scenes stuff before they had it set up were riding their one wheels crazily through an empty mall. I have been to malls. The Salina Mall in Salina, Kansas, is so empty that it's weird going into, because it is so. I remember, again, when we were in college, Matthew, that Salina Mall was packed all of the time.
The Sunset Mall had everything.
And now, derelict. Like, half the mall is derelict. There's one in Hutchinson, too, that I remember, that you go in and there's like four stores in the entire mall that are still open. And it's spooky to go into. I mean, there's like holes in the concrete that go down. Yep. Like, it's like, how does a mall just sitting empty? How does the tile buckle in the middle of the floor and then eat itself down into a 6-inch depression? But Sears is closed. You know, Sears has gone bankrupt. Radio Shack is no longer part of the mall. JCPenney has shrunk. Kmart is no longer there. The malls are shrinking. So if we're looking for hope in the future, if this is supposed to show us the way, then we can all rest assured that the mall culture will return in 2169.
See, there's a really big, famous, used to be an awesome mall here in town.
Yes, the White Lakes Mall.
The White Lakes Mall, they actually literally had to go in recently and clear out an enclave of homeless people because the building has not just black mold, not just basements full of standing brackish water, but there is now loose asbestos coming down from the ceiling.
Oh, man.
And they literally don't know how they can clean this place up. They don't have the resources necessary to clean it up without literally just tearing the whole mess down.
Back in my day, that was the mall to go to. Now, I don't know where, how often you went to Topeka when you were growing up in Beloit. But for me, that was a multi times a month occurrence where I would drive up from my little small town to go buy comic books, to go to the mall, to the bookstores. Yep. I mean, the White Lakes Mall, as small as it was, still had two bookstores, had the B. Dalton and it had the other one, not B. Dalton Booksellers, but I can't remember the name of the other brand bookstore that was popular at that time. But I mean,
Ted's Books.
No, and they had the video arcade, all of that stuff. None of that is there anymore in the malls. And I mean, that's a comment on consumerism. That's a comment on how we interact socially. It is a commentary on just consumerism.
I think the availability of online shopping is definitely
definitely plays a big role in that. But I'm just saying the mall was at one point a very important part of our society. And it's not anymore.
It was a central focal point of your city. Your organization of your city was often around those shopping establishments. I mean, if you come to Topeka now, one of the main streets in town, Wanamaker, is that because they built the West Ridge Mall out there.
Yep.
At the time, there wasn't anything out there. They built a mall, and as Kevin Costner discovered, they built it, and the people came.
Yes, they did, and that was, I remember when that mall opened up and how it had an impact on White Lakes, and then ever since then, I've never driven down Wanamaker. I've never driven down that main strip that heads south out of town. I don't know if that's Wanamaker or whatever
Topeka
it is. Whatever.
Boulevard.
Topeka Boulevard. I haven't driven down that in years.
White Lake Mall is,
I haven't driven down that street in years.
I have to get home.
Yeah, I figured you did because you live in unincorporated Pauline. But it is just...
Hey, don't tell people where I live.
Well, you're not going to live there for much longer, so it doesn't matter.
But they might come and find me. I mean, they're by not the time this episode airs,
you
I'll have
tonight?
Already been moved.
Anyway... We have Ultra Boy walking down the mall, giggle, giggle
Let's
in the background.
Go to the mall.
The mall has it all. But
then he's
assaulted by robots.
Robots attack.
When did the Thor villain? Is it the Destroyer?
The Destroyer, 1966.
So this looks to me an awful lot like a combination between Gort and the Destroyer.
I think that what you were actually seeing is that both the Destroyer and this robot take their cues from a traditional suit of armor.
Mm-hmm.
Your medieval kind of, hello, I am sirloin of beef kind of armor with, the faceplate and strip mail. I don't remember what
chain
you call
mail,
it.
Yeah.
This is not chain mail.
It's like banded armor.
Banded mail. Yeah. So you have that sort of armored Knigget thing going on here that I think carried over into the design of the Destroyer.
Okay, I can understand that. But this Destroyer just punches Ultra Boy right in his face and knocks him out. And then the guy from the musical shows up and is trying to tell people how they can buy a monorail.
That starts with T and that stands for trouble.
And that rhymes with P and that spells for protector robot.
Yeah, it's definitely a protection racket. Because this schmuck, Kozvar, and his partner, Zorla, actually beat up one of the main protectors of the galaxy to sell robots They're trying to get the United Council Security or the United Planet Security Council. The United Council Security Planet is an entirely different thing. But the United Planet Security Council, they want them to buy robots to protect each world.
Well, and I don't even know if it's just the council that has to do it. Planets by themselves could go and get these robots. And that is what the Legion fear. It's like if every planet is going out and getting these protector robots, they're going to have no need for us. And then poor Tinsel's family won't even be able to eat.
That's true. Well, they could eat robots.
Well, they could, but, you know.
But Kosvar actually shows up at Legion headquarters and he's like, hey, you guys, here's a tape of my robot beating up your former leader. You guys suck. We are a superior project.
This guy is, what's his name? Robertson. Cliff Robertson meets, is it Cliff Robertson that I'm thinking of, or I'm thinking of somebody
Cliff
else?
Cliff Robertson was in Charlie.
Okay, yes. Well, it is part Cliff Robertson, but also who's the music man?
Edward G. Robinson.
No, it's not. It's not him.
Jimmy.
Robert Preston. That's who I'm thinking of. Harold Hill and Robert Preston. Also, this guy feels like a used car salesman, all wrapped into one. Also, what's his name? Michael Douglas from Wall Street, all just mixed into one.
I was getting a little bit of Alec Baldwin and Glengarry Glen Ross.
Maybe a little bit of that, too. You know, always be name? Selling robots.
What's my name? Kosvar. Kosvar is my name.
Always be selling robots.
Exactly.
A-S-B-R.
Flight rings are for closers.
Yes, that's right.
But the flight rings end up being for everybody. And there's a very telling moment in this issue because this is the first issue where Karate Kid is actually depicted as the leader of the team. And given this quandary, this existential problem, his first response is, I wish Chameleon Boy was here because he's the Legion leader and I could dump this in his lap.
That's not how a leader is supposed to act at all.
And that's the thing. He's like, he's the leader of the espionage squad. I could just flip this off. And it's such a weird thing to see a character who is so unsuited for leadership.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also neat.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think that it's entirely intentional.
No, I don't think so either.
I think that it's neat to see Karate Kid so far out of his element and calling in for help and only getting, we've got Shrinking Violet and Light Lass and Timberwolf. What are we going to do?
Yeah. Well, one of the other things that they're concerned about is that if every planet starts buying these protector robots, it's going to lead to another arms race, which, interestingly, when you look at the Cold War and everything that was going on during the arms race, mm-hmm. actually ties back in a little bit into our mall conversation a moment ago. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that happened, well, not only were there's the proliferation of nuclear devices, eight of which destroy, you know, going off at any one time could kill all life on the planet.
Right.
But one of the big things that came out of this was that in 1953, Eisenhower approved the interstate road system and actually improved the road systems in general so that if there was a need to use the military to get from one place to another very quickly, they would have a road system in place to do that. Eisenhower was very impressed with the Autobahn that the Germans had up to World War II and then after, and saw that as a terrific way to move the military if you needed to. Now, part of the upshot of that was that we could now move very quickly from one place to another, just the general public. I mean, here in Kansas, again, we talk about Kansas a lot because Matthew and I are here and this is our frame of reference. But sure. Running right from Hayes to Russell and really all the way to Topeka is a road system called Highway 40. And Highway 40 is a two-lane structure that you can't drive fast on, you cannot pass easily on, and before the Interstate I-70 was built, that was the only way you could get from town to town, and it was a slow process, and it would take hours and sometimes days to get from one end of the state to another in that road system. However, once the interstate system moved in and the road structure and the infrastructure of the U.S. improved post-World War II, people realized that they no longer had to live in the big cities to commute in to go and work. You know, you could live out in the suburbs and you could go to the train station or you could drive the interstate system in. You had, for the, you know, the actual phrase used, the white flight from the city where white people were moving out into the suburbs. And because they were out in the suburbs and you didn't want to drive back into the city to do your shopping, that is one of the things that led to the rise of
the shopping mall.
The shopping mall. So this is a weird kind of thing that just kind of struck me as I'm reading about this fear of this, not just the nuclear arm proliferation, which is going on right now, but also just the fact that it's very cyclical in that the road system helped people move out. They also needed a place to shop. The strip malls and the shopping malls all became a big thing. And we're right back at the beginning of the show, except here we go to Jupiter, where these robots are being built. And we're not only introduced into Kosovar Kramer is his name.
Kosovar Kramer.
We are also introduced to his tiara wearing lady friend.
She's dressed like the May Queen in the Spring Festival. She looks like she's in a fourth grade play playing the setting sun. It's like someone did a really bad Shakespearean adaptation and Romeo's like, "Why, for art there, Romeo, look," and Juliet is the sun and she comes out dressed
literally
as
the sun. I forget what her name is.
But Zorla.
It's Zorla. And Kosovar is very excited because the fourth richest woman in the galaxy or the universe, Karina Walter, is coming to pay him a visit to check out the building of the robots. And while Karina is being toured around, Kosovar is like, "Here, lady, let me just take your arm here and you can follow me, see?" And he takes her around and we discover that both Mon-El and Superboy have been kidnapped. And Kosovar has been doing tests on them to steal their powers to basically build these robots based on their powers.
Now, this does raise an important question. How in the holy hubs of horticulture did this man capture Superboy and Mon-El?
Oh, that's a story that I'm sure they go into great detail on, because taking down two of the greatest superheroes in the universe is probably big, exciting, and super neat.
No, it's actually thrown aside as I've been experimenting with super hypnosis. I was surprised it worked too.
I know, isn't that kind of funny where he's just like, "Oh yeah, I've been practicing with super hypnosis. Who would have known it worked?" Also,
I'm just like, he reminds me of Lex Luthor from the Superman film in 77.
Yeah, yeah. Also, he's secretly been projecting super hypnotic rays into this woman's head so that she'll be super attracted to him, because the next thing that happens is the only thing that popped into my mind was, what in the heck in Me Too movement is going on with this story? Because Kosovar gets super handsy super quick.
And he starts chasing Karina around a table. I mean, it's like an episode of Bewitched.
And it starts making out with her. And it's like, "Let's seal this deal with a kiss, baby."
Oh, yeah. And that's when the other shoe drops.
Now, before we get to the other shoe dropping, I should say that this is not probably shocking for the time period.
No, I think that this is actually kind of a silly ha-ha joke. The chasing a girl around a table, the slapping a secretary on the behind.
Yeah, going to the Playboy Club, this rise of the macho era.
Yeah, it's inappropriate. It's not totally acceptable now, but in 1969, it was something that people would still joke about, and it was still part of the culture in a way that, you know, I think it's still part of the culture now, but it was a larger part and
more accepted
of the culture that people weren't hiding or ashamed of in 1969.
Right. Meanwhile, under a rivet.
Shrinking Violet returns to Legion something.
No,
something.
She went to Jupiter. She's on this ship that Karina took with him. It turns out this isn't Karina at all, but it is in fact Light Lass. Also, we find out that Karate Kid is here wearing something called the Chameleoid costume.
We don't know what that is.
I mean, I'm sure that the entire Legion uses this again and again and again in all their adventures, because all Chameleon Boy Karate Kid has to do is Timberwolf. All Timberwolf has to do is turn a little knob on his suit and suddenly he can look like anyone else in the facility. It's like a magic hat. If you were playing a D&D game and you wanted to look like someone else, it's a hat of disguise is what it is. And I'm sure going on from here on until the end of the Legion run, Matthew, the Chameleoid costume is something that is used all of the time.
I think everyone listening knows from the tone of your voice that that is not the case.
So anyway, Karate Kid has been waiting outside, waiting for a signal. And when Lightning Lass detects that there may be a problem. She signals Karate Kid to come in. He comes in, and Timberwolf, because he's in disguise, doesn't want everything to fall apart, so he then has to attack Karate Kid with his stun gun.
Yep, and then they fight. And I will say this for Timberwolf. It's a short fight. We don't see a lot of it. But he seems to hold his own against Karate Kid.
Well, and that's because Karate Kid figures out right away. Why would he be, oh, I see, there's the evil wicked witch staring at me. I got to play along to make it look like this is a fair thing, not to give away his cover.
Right. And then they fight. And then, of course, we get the thing.
Yes, where she turns on the view screen and sees Kozvar macking out with Lightning Lass.
And literally, our second suicide ending in four issues. She's like, oh, everybody get out. Legionnaires, go. I'm about to kill me and my boyfriend.
Oh, man. She just doesn't kill me and my boyfriend. She doesn't pull out a gun and blow him away and then turn it on herself.
She pushes the self-destruct button on the entire robot factory.
And the whole thing explodes in a giant, like, weird, it's a fascinating panel.
It's a mushroom cloud.
But we see a giant mushroom cloud just exploding over the planet Jupiter. And that's how we ended up with the red spot.
Yeah, that's what happens. Also, in that final panel, the Legion cruiser looks eerily like the Starship Enterprise.
It does in multiple panels. It looks like this. And we know, and we've talked about this before, that Jim Shooter is doing a lot of the pencils, right? Now, we don't know if this issue specifically was Wynn Mortimer based on Shooter layouts.
This one did not indicate, based on the best, the Grand Comics database's best guesses, mm-hmm. that this is from Shooter layouts. That actually stopped when they moved over to Action. We stopped reading it like that, and they stopped saying, this is definitely from Shooter layouts.
Well, so. I mean, we're in 1969. Star Trek is on the air. We're actually just about to end, right?
Yeah. I think it's just off the air in 69, but, you know, there's Land of the Giants. There's Land of the Lost. There's,
I mean, but it definitely looks like a, hey, here, I love the design of mm-hmm. the Enterprise. Let's see if we can do something similar without getting CBS Paramount yelling at us.
Well, wait till Dave Cockrum shows up.
Yeah, I cannot wait
then
for that.
Then those ships really look some Trekkiness.
This is a weird, weird issue. It's got a horrible ending.
It's not very good.
I mean,
we've talked about these last page kind of, oops, we're out of time, bye. But this one is literally, hey, let's just nuke the entire site from orbit. It's the only way to be sure.
We have come to the end of another Legion Clubhouse. Matthew, what have we learned this week?
I think that first and foremost, we've learned that in the future, you're probably going to want to kill yourself.
I think also, depending on your political affiliation, maybe you wouldn't be poor if you would just stop buying comic books.
And most importantly, we learned that Vi forgot how to program the cosmetic computer and couldn't do her makeup.
That wraps it up for this installment of the Legion Clubhouse. Thank you, everyone, for downloading, checking us out, giving us those 5-star reviews over on the Apple Podcast. We certainly appreciate that. You also can follow us at Major Spoilers. You can also follow us at Mighty King Cobra. We also have a Legion Clubhouse Twitter feed that you can follow us at Legion Clubhouse. We certainly appreciate everyone who follows us there, because that's where I usually give some heads up on when an issue is about to release. I think that's where we're going to wrap it up again. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time. I'm Moan Schleicher.
And I'm Monica Lewinsky.
The Legion Clubhouse is a production of Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC, and is produced by Steven Schleicher. Your hosts were Matthew Peterson and Steven Schleicher. You can follow Matthew at Mighty King Cobra and Steven at Major Spoilers. You can follow this podcast on Twitter at Legion Clubhouse. If you have questions or comments, send them to podcast@majorspoilers.com. I'm Jason Inman. Until next time, eat it, Grandpa.
This podcast is copyright 2019 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.